everybody, and thank you for tuning in to another episode of RVA Tech Talks. This is Ford, your host. And just as a quick reminder, this is a podcast about Richmond technologists. And I sit down with some of the most brilliant minds of Richmond's tech scene and ask them about what they're up to and kind of break down the keys to their success. Thanks so much to this week's sponsor, Summit Human Capital. Summit Human Capital is thrilled because they just celebrated their second year here in business in the Richmond area. And their founder and CEO is actually a born and bred Richmond native. And Summit Human Capital, as a result, is all in when it comes to supporting the tremendous growth in the tech sector here in Richmond. And they accomplish all this by providing world-class premier IT human capital solutions. And they focus these solutions not only on bringing top talent into the Richmond area, they help to retain the top talent here in the Richmond community. And our guest today, Pablo Ormachea. Pablo is the VP and head of data science, head of sales analytics, and in-house counsel at West Creek Financial, which is a startup here in the Richmond area. Pablo and I sat down and had a wide-ranging and fascinating conversation that covered his journey from being a Harvard Law student to being a tech leader here in the Richmond area. And along the way, we cover some of the really fascinating sort of research-based work that Pablo has done around sort of policymaking and blending together data science to kind of improve the society that we live in overall. It was an absolutely fascinating conversation. And we also dived into some of the basic business principles behind West Creek and how sort of data is used to, for example, catch fraud, and also dive into some of the secret sauces that Pablo uses to build successful teams and just be an awesome person overall. Oh, and quick note, while Pablo at the time of this interview was working at West Creek, he is going to be branching out very soon on a new exciting venture in a similar space. And if you're interested in learning more about this venture or working with Pablo or just working at West Creek Financial in general, reach out via LinkedIn. So without further ado, I give you Pablo. Because you are from?
Houston. And other than my three-year stint in Boston, I've lived in Houston, Lima, and Miami. So Houston was actually technically the coldest place I'd ever lived until here, aside from my law school experience.
Wait, so, okay, I should probably say thanks, Pablo, for coming on the show. And I've given your intro, but I wanted to ask a bunch of questions. But now I want to ask about, you're a Houston guy.
Yes.
But you also have roots in Lima? You lived in Lima?
Most of my teenage years I spent in Lima. And I miss it. In my opinion, my favorite food in the world is from down there.
Okay.
Like their ceviche, their seafood, like all that stuff. Like the potatoes from down there, the avocados from down there, all that stuff is amazing.
They have avocados? And
that's where it came from.
Oh, I thought avocados were like a California thing. Like only.
Transplanted. So the Incans used to have agriculture on the side of the mountains, and they'd intentionally make flat spots.
Yeah.
And they knew the climate and the altitude so well that they would grow different things at different places. And so they had an avocado area. They also had a coca leaf area that they used to use for tea. But all of these were at like incredibly precise spots in terms of elevation that are actually pretty stunning.
Wait, so we took avocados from the Incans?
We exported them out. And same thing with the potatoes. So they have like over 130 different kinds of potatoes down there. And when I went down there with my wife a few years back, she tried to eat them all and she gave up after about 30 something.
Wow. So, you know, people, you heard it here first. Avocados are from South America and potatoes. I think I heard potatoes previously, but I completely forgot. Mm-hmm. I'd have potatoes.
That's what they told me. Yeah. But Peruvians are pretty proud people, so if I'm wrong, I apologize.
And then you've lived somewhere else.
So I'm half Nicaraguan, half Bolivian, and my Bolivian side of the family has had a lot of roots in Miami for a long time. So I used to spend a lot of time either working in Miami or visiting Miami for long stints to see my dad.
Okay.
And so, yeah, Richmond is, aside from my law school stint, the coldest place I've ever lived.
How are you handling it?
I make more money now, so I can buy clothing to handle it better than when I was younger. But it's actually not that bad. My wife and kids are disappointed that this is the very first snowfall we've had all winter.
I feel bad for them.
Yep.
This is a super just like underwhelming show of snow.
Yep. My five-year-old actually cried when we told her it's not going to be enough for you to see tomorrow.
That's real. Those emotions are real. All right. So you spend time in these places, most notably Houston, and then you get your career started in, well, I guess you go to school in Boston.
Yeah. So I went to law school at Harvard. I specialized in using data, actually really building data sets to figure out if the assumptions were true. So at law school, We're taught to see the laws as a series of incentives and disincentives, that we're trying to pull levers as people that are social engineers. And that's actually a really cool way that I've heard people explain what good lawyers and good people who build legal systems are trying to do. Mm-hmm. It's social engineering of human processes. Mm-hmm. And if you set up the right incentives or disincentives, in theory, you'll change behavior. And so a success story for this is drunk driving. So we built some neat data sets in Houston looking at criminal arrests all the way back to 1972. And so we had every single adult criminal arrest that hadn't been sealed, and not very many are sealed, from 72 to 2012. And we would look at different crimes over time and look for changes. And one of the most stunning ones was drunk driving. Drunk driving arrests were meaningfully higher in the 70s and early 80s. And when I asked people qualitatively who were around back then, actually at trials, it seemed that part of the problem was that people saw themselves more like the person on the stand, because it was so common to drink and drive, mm-hmm. than as the family members who were mourning whoever was lost. And then we started doing things like changing the drinking age, being real particular with blue ribbon commissions under Reagan on blood alcohol contents. Mothers Against Drunk Driving started, and all of
so
these.
This is data labels you're applying to these certain years,
yeah. Yes,
to retroactively figure out what the effect was?
That's right.
Okay.
And some of it's a just-so story. Like, so the problem with social studies is I can't tell you that conclusively that this is what caused it.
Right.
But when it fits the facts so well, and it's also what people would all hypothesize would help,
yeah.
we feel pretty strongly inclined to say that's probably it.
Yeah.
And so what you see is a spike, again, when the drinking age goes down, dramatic, for the number of arrests for a year. But then that spike comes down really fast. And it's not because the police officers stopped arresting people. It's because people started changing their behavior. And when you look at interviews from just after that time, you now start seeing a lot more people talking as if they see themselves more like the family member that lost a person than the person that's on the stand. And then today, it's amazing. I see this massive generational change with Uber and Lyft, where the people that are slightly older than me will still drink and drive. Mm-hmm. Not as much, maybe a drink or two. But the people younger than me, if they just have one or two, they'll just be like, man, go get an Uber. Why wouldn't you do that?
Right.
And so that, I think that's been a wonderful success story.
Wait, so just to take a step back. So you're getting this law degree.
Yes.
And you're studying all these different types of law. At what point do the legal professors or in your curriculum, do they say, hey, let's start looking at data. Let's start building data sets. Let's start informing our education about the law in the light of data?
So law schools are a collection of people with different axes to grind, if I'm being uncharitable, or with different preferences for how you do analysis, if I'm being more charitable.
Okay.
And so you tend to have like cliques almost of different approaches. And so there's a law and economics clique. There's a critical theory clique. But then the one that I liked, the clique that I sort of joined, is not going to be a surprise since I'm a data scientist, is the empirical analysis of the law clique. And so this was actually the only group that was focused on using data as opposed to really well-structured language to try to explain things.
Interesting.
And so it was more like philosophy versus philosophy grounded in numbers. And
is this normal? Like at most law schools, do they have these different cliques that go really deep on one little vertical?
It is in the ones that are known for academic research.
Okay,
so I can't speak to the ones that don't tend to get lots of research going and lots of projects going. But
there's research going on at Harvard Law.
Yes.
Okay, I had no idea. I thought Harvard Law was just pumping out JDs.
Interesting story. I know Elizabeth Warren pretty well because she was my Harvard Law professor. Every single semester I was there, I took something from her.
Interesting.
I've been to her house. And the reason I'm bringing it up now is she actually was one of the most prominent people pushing for using data to test assumptions. And she built what was known as the Bankruptcy Research Project. So she is literally the nation's preeminent expert in how bankruptcy affects people because she built this data set. So every single bankruptcy ever filed, she went through it with her team and coded it. And she has partners out of U of H, University of Houston Law School, that worked on it too. And it's actually really interesting, and I don't mean to divert into politics here, but just to give some perspective about her as a person, she originally started this project because she was convinced that she was going to find that people were just spending themselves foolishly into oblivion, and that's why they were going into bankruptcy, mm-hmm. just overusing credit cards.
All right.
And she finished.
That's definitely my idea of it.
Yeah.
It's irresponsibility that causes it.
And she ended the project actually having completely changed her mind. 70% of the people that go to bankruptcy did it because of a major medical event. And that's why she ends up pushing things like medical reform. It comes from it comes from a data-driven conclusion. I'm not saying it's the right, recommendation, but it comes from a place of data.
Yeah.
And that's what informed her opinion. And as part of that, one of the interesting things that she analyzed was that we've actually become a lot more fragile as people, as little nuclear families than we used to be.
That makes sense.
So if you think about it, we used to be single-income families, right? Like go back several decades and that was the norm.
Right.
And then we added a new income for those of us that are lucky enough to have a stable partner. And yet it's not like those people are overflowing in money. They don't have truly double the spending power. It's because a lot of things just went up to match. So housing in good school districts almost went up linearly to take all that money away. And so if one of the two people now – you've increased your risk, right? If one of the two people has a problem medical that stops them from working for long enough, the whole house of cards comes crashing down.
Yeah. Interesting. Because when I think about dual income, I think of resiliency. That's the intuitive response. But really, it's risk because the water levels have increased in terms of overhead.
Yes. And we've actually did it to ourselves. Like we all collectively bid up the property values of good school district areas significantly more than anywhere else.
Yeah. Okay. So you sold me on it. data and law school can go together.
They can.
That's super cool. That makes me super hopeful about law school in general because I have sort of a pessimistic like I'm like lawyers. They're just using words. They're just like making this like syrupy soup of words, and then they're trying to change things with that.
Well, most experience with lawyers are people who tell them no, right? Like no, you can't do that. No, you shouldn't do it this way. And so I get why most people have a bad opinion about lawyers.
Totally. Well, so from there, you graduate, and do you know exactly what you want to do? Or did you have this moment when you graduate where you're like, I could do like 8 different things?
Well, when I was at law school, I was pretty convinced I was going to be a legal academic using data to make decisions.
Okay.
But I was in no rush to get there. Like a tenure track position like that is a lifetime thing. Mm-hmm. And I was like 24 or something, and that just didn't appeal to me yet. But I graduated at a really interesting time. I graduated in 2008.
Okay.
And so I was recruited. The way recruitment works at law schools is you're actually hired the year before. So I was recruited and given offers in the absolute peak of the boom pre-2008. But then when I graduated, major law firms were all laying people off.
Oh, interesting.
And so I
had like, oh, wait, sorry.
Well, because these corporate law firms that pay well that recruit from my type of school, they're like extra corporate.
Yeah.
They serve corporate clients. So if anything happens on the corporate side, whether it's a boom or a bust, they feel it harder. It's like they're the outside part of the wheel.
Oh, yeah.
And so I went to a law firm and a great one that I'm lucky to have gotten to work with, one of the very best in the country called Sussman Godfrey out of Houston. They specialize in huge cases. Like they had a $400 million settlement, I believe, against Microsoft without filing any paperwork.
Wow.
Like they're really good at what they do.
Yeah.
So I started.
Wait, by the way, is there like a synergy between Houston and you know, Cambridge or wherever Harvard is?
Not really.
Okay.
I probably benefited from geographic diversity.
Okay. Just wanted to ask because I feel like I keep hearing these links between Houston but maybe the link is you.
Maybe. Thank you. That's too much credit.
Okay. So you got this awesome job at a Houston law firm.
Yeah, but it was intended to be short. I had a clerkship lined up after that in South Florida, Miami, to work for a judge. Part of the problem in law school is all we do is minimize risk, right? That's what lawyers specialize in. And one of the ways you minimize risk is by getting badges that you can point to on your resume. And it actually never stops. So getting to a good law school is a wonderful badge. Graduating well is a badge. Going to a good law firm is a badge. And everybody does these things because they think they help them later.
Getting that clerkship.
Getting a clerkship is a badge.
Yeah.
That's like our current Chief Justice was a Supreme Court clerk before.
Yeah.
Right. So like these badges are extremely important, but the badges never stop.
They never
say that I've got enough. I did it. I'm successful.
Yeah.
And to be honest, one of my failings is that I find new things interesting and I have trouble figuring out the difference between liking it because it's new versus liking it because of the thing.
Interesting.
And so I realized when I started working full time at the law firm that it really wasn't a good fit for me because I don't like doing something that somebody else will do just as well. And there were so many people that were eligible to take my seat that it didn't feel like I was moving the needle.
Right.
So then I go to this clerkship and I spent literally a third of my time. I counted one week, a third of my time just checking for like commas and periods and spacing and parentheticals. And I'm like, Pablo, really, this is what you train for? And so ended up leaving that and didn't like working at the law firm, didn't like the clerkship experience. So I decided, you know what?
What's the time frame, by the way, for right now?
We are about a year out from me having graduated from law school.
Okay. Were you starting to kind of just like doubt yourself?
About the legal work. At law school, I loved it because I did all the legal academic work.
Right.
Like I maximized the number of independent credits I was allowed to get for writing and doing all kinds of research and collaborating closely with professors, and that was exciting. But it doesn't pay as well. It's also really easy at a law school like that to just walk into a well-paying job.
Yeah.
But I decided, you know what, I'm going to go back in time and I'm going to do what I wanted to do before my family talked me into going to law school, which was teach at a low-income school district. I had a Teach for America placement lined up that I didn't take. So I ended up teaching for a few years in Houston at a really good low-income school where I got to learn a lot about how they were using data. They actually won prizes for how they use data to leverage student outcomes. And I actually got to see the negative side of it. We essentially did standardized testing to our kids every 4 to 6 weeks, and it was as much as a bar exam in terms of time. Like they would spend 3 days doing nothing but bubbling Scantrons, which is not what we want, I think, in an education system.
Yeah.
But then I flipped over to one of the very best, actually probably the best school in Texas in terms of college placements, and I got to see the other side. And yeah, they didn't do any bubbling of Scantrons there, right? So what a surprise.
Yeah.
But it was fascinating to get to teach in both places, get to see what was really effective, and I've actually learned—
So you were teaching and you were involved in sort of looking at outcomes?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so that was actually, it was really fascinating. I really loved that work. I really loved learning about how people evaluate things. And I actually started looking deep into some of the weaknesses in rating teachers and the like, because it's a difficult problem. You have very few data points, just a few kids, and the kids are not necessarily randomly assigned. So I taught English as a second language. So like by default, my kids' scores are going to be lower than the gifted talented score.
Sure, yeah.
So how much credit do you give to the teacher? Some of them try to do magic by looking at how they performed the year before, but it's very few data points. So if one or two kids are having a rough family situation, it'll change your entire average quite a bit. And nobody's gotten a silver bullet for how to figure this out. But one of the beauties of this, and one of the reasons I went this route, is that I kind of miss how the United States used to we used to have a culture of exploration, of curiosity, of invention that wasn't just at our work. I look at every single one of our founding fathers. Every single one of them is we know, did something else. Like Thomas Jefferson used to make different nails, right? George Washington would explore different ways of farming. Ben Franklin is famous for the kite with the key. And so I miss that. And we're too good at squeezing what valuable people do. So teaching let me also just explore things. So I voraciously read how our minds are consistently irrational, like what the consistent cognitive flaws are that we make.
Yeah.
And that's how I came across work from David Eagleman, who's a neuroscientist or was a neuroscientist out of Baylor College of Medicine, now Stanford, and ended up running into this guy at a presentation to my school. Talked, he invited me down to his lab, ended up working with him, and that's how I walked into a postdoc in neuroscience and started doing the criminal research work.
Okay, so you ended up doing – how long was that for? I didn't realize that you also did more education more research, I guess.
More that did that for about 5 years.
Oh, wow.
Where we landed a lot. I mean, part of the reason that he got me is that most lawyers can write pretty well.
Yeah.
And it's persuasive writing in particular that we're taught how to do, but in a way that it's meant to seem objective, right? Which is a hard balance to strike.
Yeah.
But it turns out it's a really useful skill for writing grant applications to the federal government. And so we landed some really nice large grants to build that data set that I mentioned earlier to you, looking at arrest records from 70s to present for many cities and many states across the country. Also landed a grant to build a predictive software tool where people could run through interactive games very quickly in under 30 minutes, and we could actually predict reoffense at least as well as an hour and a half interview can.
Wow.
Just off of 30 minutes of somebody playing games.
Okay, so this guy is a neuroscientist.
Yes.
But he's also interested in like essentially statistics, machine learning, things that like being able to predict things in the future.
Yes, he is. I'd say even more than that, he's interested in entrepreneurship. He loves to bring together innovative ideas and apply them in a way that can move the needle somehow. And so I got to learn a lot about how to start and fundraising and the like from him. And I'm always going to be eternally grateful for that. So he's launched a few startups. So a similar product to this tablet product that's done pretty well, I think it just closed a Series B in Houston, is for concussion and dementia predictions. So on the sideline, in under 5 minutes in an athletic game, they can predict who would reoffend. And I helped build the initial models for that. Sorry, not reoffend, but who has a concussion. Then they have another set, which is even cooler. So he had a really high profile TED Talk. It was considered the TED Talk of the year that year. Where
what's this guy's name again?
David Eagleman.
David Eagleman.
Yeah.
E-G-L-E-N.
Eagle like the American Eagle.
Okay.
And then man.
All right.
And all right. It's this really neat vest. So he and this PhD student I'm really close friends with called Scott Novick had designed essentially, and I don't know how much, I'll just say many different motors. In different spots around a vest, and they do some really sophisticated algorithms to transform noise into meaningful pieces on those motors, and they could get people who were completely deaf from birth, to understand what people were saying just off of the motors. And so there's a lot of applications for that are pretty cool. Like one of the ones that I remember people talking about was astronauts. You could give them tactile feedback while they're doing a spacewalk, to know exactly where things are, where they're not, how they should move. You could also do it for people that are drone pilots, so they can feel the pitch, the yaw, and everything perfectly as they're doing it. So it was really innovative stuff. And what was even more impressive than just the sheer imaginative innovation was how good he was about turning this into an effective story that explained how it solved the problem.
Right.
And then taking that to market. So both of these are now
wow.
past the Series B. That's part of the reason he moved to Stanford.
So is he a professor or is he...
He was a professor at Baylor College of Medicine, and he is a professor over at Stanford as well. But I think he's he's an adjunct at Stanford since he spends more of his time with these companies now.
Okay, gotcha. Wow. Okay, I feel like my head is spinning.
Yeah. Well, I would have help with a lot of consulting on all the startup work, and so you can tell where the startup genes, like where the spark
yeah.
came from.
Yeah. No, it makes perfect sense. It seems like you just hang out with a lot of, or you have sought out the presence of a lot of interesting, multidisciplinary, outside the box thinkers and doers, I guess, more importantly.
Yeah, I've been very blessed. I've gotten to work with some incredible people in all parts of their fields, from that law firm to David Eagleman to where I am today.
Yeah.
And I've gotten to learn very concrete things from each of them along the way that I try to use.
Yeah.
So David Eagleman, one of his other amazing attributes is I've never heard the man sound disagreeable. Like he can disagree. He can disagree forcefully, but the way he does it, you're going to think he's there's no pain there. It's amazing.
Wow.
And then that's part of the reason that I was open to the opportunity that I got here at Richmond. And so West Creek Financial is a pretty successful local startup that's been profitable since 18. They reached out to me in March and were really interested in giving me the opportunity to help build an innovative team of data scientists and develop a team that were doing really cool things in the financial services space.
How did they find you?
LinkedIn is an amazing thing.
Okay, so they just saw some guy who was doing – were you – like what was your kind of role before this? Were you in the tech field as like part of a tech team, or were you just in this weird research lab out in California?
That's a great question. So my research lab was in Houston. He moved out to California essentially towards the last year of my work with him. But I there's a lot of ways to describe what I did with him. One way to describe it would be that I was a project designer, planner, implementer, and good at getting the funding to get it done. Mm. And so that was a lot of product management, a hell of a lot of data science work with modeling and the like and design as well. And so it was always about assembling teams. That's really what it boiled down to, mm-hmm. was assembling the right teams to solve the problem
right.
that would persuade these extremely well-educated and sharp people on these panels at government research proposal
yeah.
places like the National Science Foundation that we could actually accomplish the thing that we were setting out for. And then also predicting criminal reoffense is not that dissimilar from predicting failure to pay.
Yeah.
And all of the skills about explaining complicated things to people that are not used to necessarily that particular field
mm-hmm.
Are also useful when you're talking to executives, no matter how sharp they are, no matter how much they know. It's hard to stay on top of all the changes. And as you guys know, these fields change so fast that you have to learn to rely on somebody that can stay on top of that stuff and explain and tease apart exactly what they want to use to apply it to today.
Totally. Okay, so you West Creek sells you on coming out here, and
it wasn't just West Creek. I got to give Richmond credit. I actually took the time to have my Uber driver drive me around for like 45 minutes just to see what it was like.
That's awesome.
And I got to say, this place is beautiful. Maybe not right now with no leaves and a little bit of ice
right.
on the ground, but this place is beautiful.
I'd like to pause for a moment to give a quick shout out to this week's sponsor, Summit Human Capital. Over the past 2 years, having earned the confidence of their clientele and the love of their clientele, covering the industries of government services, healthcare, IT, supply chain, logistics, and so on, the folks at Summit Human Capital have achieved a 2,000% growth rate, and they've established a huge family consisting of over 30 associates over 10 states. Their mission is pretty simple. They want to build deep, profound, and genuine relationships, and in turn, positively change lives. If you're a candidate that's ready to make another career move, or if you're an employer with a talent gap on your specific team or in the overall IT department, please reach out to summithumancapital.com and allow these folks to prove why their retention rate is far higher than the industry standard. Summit Human Capital, positively changing lives by connecting talent to opportunity. So what's your favorite thing about Richmond? If you, aside from the just the general beauty, what's your favorite thing to do or favorite thing about Richmond that made you think like, yeah, I could call this home?
It's very livable. So I live 4 minutes from work, and I have a nice house in the very nicest school district probably in the area in Glen Allen. And it costs me less than the apartment I had in Houston. So that's part of it. That's appealing.
Yeah.
But the favorite thing, well, I gained 15 pounds when I first moved here because there's so much good beer.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
But then the other one is just how many natural resources you guys have within 3 hours. The ability to drive out to Shenandoah National Park and do some great hiking and actually come back the same day if I want to. It is amazing. And to go to Virginia Beach or any of the beaches out there, and again, just within a 2.5 hour drive is fantastic. It used to take me – well, Big Bend National Park is in Texas. It's a 12-hour drive from Houston.
That's a long
drive. That's a long drive.
Yeah.
And then our state parks are good – like the ones that are worth anything are a good 6 or 7 hours away.
I totally take that for granted. And then we get D.C. We have where the brain of our nation is essentially like the decision making – it's just like, you know, I could take the train for 2 hours and I'm there.
And I love D.C. Like, I love touring it. I used to go there as a leader of school trips for eighth graders. So I was one of those annoying guys telling people to get to the side of the sidewalk.
Yeah. Okay. So you go to this company called West Creek. Mm-hmm. Can you explain in a word what West Creek does?
In one word?
Well.
Lending.
Lending. Okay. How about in like 20 words?
Okay. West Creek partners with stores that sell more necessities, so furniture, mattress, appliance, tires are currently where we specialize, and offers lending to people that other people turn down.
Gotcha. So if I go to the mattress store or the furniture store and I see this ottoman I love and I go to apply for some credit and they turn me down, am I thanks to West Creek, am I not even seeing that because the sort of the lending – is behind the scenes going from whoever the default is to West Creek?
Well, we've been actually building out and we're, I think, just in Virginia right now, and we're about to roll out to the East Coast.
Okay.
New products, loan products for people that are lower risk. So the new version of West Creek is going to be a single application that'll handle everyone, where we're hoping for an end-to-end approval rate of over 90%.
Gotcha. So whereas now you integrate with some other provider.
Yeah, or we're just behind them.
Gotcha.
So you might get run by a Capital One or a Wells Fargo for a credit card first in a typical store today. Their approval rates, at least for our major competitors, are pretty low. So they may approve 40%, 35% of people because they have really stiff FICO cuts and if you ever had a bankruptcy, like little like rules that make sense but are also pretty firm and not granular. Right. And what we do is we look at thousands of other data points beyond FICO, because FICO, for instance, really breaks down once you get south to about 600 FICO score. And
I mean, breaks down as in like becomes like who can guess why the score is what it is?
Well, the original score is not designed for point of sale lending. The original score was designed for mortgages decades ago.
Oh, interesting.
And so it's got this like impermanent memory to it that if you've ever defaulted on anything over a certain time frame, it's always going to be in there regardless of the size, the scale, or what it was. And it wasn't tailored for the people that are looking for small loans. It was tailored for the people that are looking for enormous ones. So it's actually – FICO is very good north of 650 or 700, which is why you see a lot of people with – if you try to go get 0% financing from an auto dealer, you should better be north of 720 on FICO because it's actually pretty good there. But for our customers
– As in reflective of – risk. Of your risk. Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
But for our customers, and I'd say two-thirds, I'd say the majority and probably the vast majority are – no, definitely the vast majority are well under that 700 FICO cutoff. Everybody, I don't know if you guys are familiar with box plots, but you can use box plots to look at the range of a score in different buckets. And so if I take everybody we ever approve, you only have to go about a quarter deep before FICO is now essentially the same for everyone, which tells you that FICO is not discriminating or splitting risk between these people at all.
Interesting. Okay.
And it's all the other stuff that we look at, most of which I can't talk about on this podcast,
right,
but that lets us approve 80% of people after somebody already had that 40% approval step. Like, so that's pretty impressive how many people that we can approve, and we can do so profitably. So only one in five people can't get money through us today.
And gotcha.
Our goal is to make it 1 in 10.
Can you give me a use case of how you might use data science? I mean, you described a scenario sort of from a business perspective of like, you know, where the value of West Creek is.
Right.
But can you describe sort of a detailed use case from like the scenario you were trying to solve, and then the maybe even the nitty gritty, like what sort of algorithms did you use? What did you build it on top of?
Sure.
From you know, soup to nuts.
Okay. It's a long one. I think a good example. So generally speaking, in the financial services space, people are more willing to talk about fraud defenses than they are about underwriting. So I'm going to switch over to the fraud space for this. But we're very good at West Creek at making money off of our consumers. We're really good at approving the right amount. Many of them take advantage of our 0% period. That part, I feel like we actually have relatively solved. There's always improvements to be made, but it's pretty well solved. The way that we ever lose money, really, in concrete, large, unexpected terms that affect the bottom line, is fraud, and fraud from our stores. And so we have a fantastic fraud team that has brought our fraud rate down astronomically since they started. But there's still ways that we leverage data science to stop it beyond the manual review that they do. And so there was one major fraud event at a store in the Midwest where it was really clever. It was really clever. I'm surprised I wasn't in a movie when I was reading about what they did. But everybody, I don't know if you know this, but you can buy IDs online. Like, you could go online and you can, if you go to the right spots, some people like to call it the dark web, yeah, it's pretty straightforward to buy stolen identifications. And they're not worth that much, sadly. But what these guys did was not just buy fake IDs or stolen IDs online. They bought the ones that were within 5-10 miles of the store. That's cool. Yeah. That's a level of sophistication already that
okay,
we hadn't seen before. And then on top of that, they bought prepaid phone numbers that were within 5 miles of the store with the right area code, and a different phone number for every person. And so a lot of the checks that we do look for things like distance. They look for anomalies and all sorts of different measures. And so we use a lot of different anomaly detection techniques,
yeah,
mostly built in Python or R, and then deployed to an AWS stack.
And those are using like public data sets to figure out, okay, like this phone number maps to this zip code maps to sort of, you know, this address, kind of like just making sure there's something wacky out there, like a zip code from Alaska. Okay, got it.
That's part of it. We also have services that we can pull from that'll give us more information about the email, phone number, address, person associated, yeah, with them, the bank account they're giving us. And what was really impressive about these guys is that every single piece of the information they used was correct because they bought it all, right? And the only piece that wasn't – they didn't match up perfectly with what our vendors had was the phone number. But at the time, it was a more expensive pull to get a lot of data on it.
Yeah.
So because they were all unique and because they were from the right area and because everything else matched, we ended up approving a lot of these fake people. And so that was a lot of money just starting to leave, if you can imagine. And none of them ever paid back.
Wait, so just for someone listening who's thinking that, like, how does this possibly happen? Like, does this not map back to their social security number somehow? Like, to some sort of primary?
It does. And it was the right social security number. And it was the right address.
Oh, so, but the person was just maybe living their life somewhere in that area, but they stole their identity, essentially.
Yes.
Got it. Okay, so it wasn't a made-up person. It was a real person.
Correct.
Whose identity was stolen.
Yeah.
And then they applied a brand new phone number to it.
Mm-hmm. You got it.
Wow. Okay.
It's very sophisticated.
That is.
And we have standard protocols that involve things like calling the customer to confirm delivery and the like, which is very common in this space. And they would answer and say yes, and it would be different people. Like, they were stunningly good at this.
Wow.
And so it defeated our supervised fraud models because we'd never seen this particular kind of fraud before. And one of the limitations of supervised models is it's only good at predicting what it's seen before. And so what we decided to do was sit down and think about intelligently about how we could stop this in the future. And we like to do things across the spectrum, from the simplest, pragmatic, to the sophisticated stuff. We don't just focus on one side or at the expense of the other. And so there's a couple simple rules that we learned. So every single one of these guys that they bought, because they wanted the highest possible lines, had a pretty good credit history. And so it's actually pretty rare for people with a great credit history to also use prepaid phones. And so that was one block that we could put in to slow this down. That's a simple one. Then we could build – we could add this to our supervised modeling data set. We have a new binary that tells us this was fraud. Retrain it. We could play with weighting this new fraud more so that we can make sure it gets caught. And then we
can – But that just sort of catches flash fraud, but it has to happen first before it's detected.
Correct. And okay. That's a limitation with that supervised model. So, but we made that improvement as well. Okay. Why not? We already have the pipeline ready to go. So then we're thinking, okay, that'll stop with what's happened, but these guys are clever. They're going to keep coming up with new ways to do it. What can we do to stop the next one? And we decided to do two different forms of anomaly detection. So traditional anomaly detection is just looking for what's different than what has been seen before. And it's not really defining that well what different means. There's a lot more art in the anomaly detection. And so we had to figure out which features we cared about, because most unsupervised methods are going to treat all features equally important because it doesn't know any better.
Tell people what a feature is.
A feature here would be a variable that we either created about the person through the application.
Like a label.
A label. It could be about their – if anybody has reported fraud on them before. So if we buy it from a vendor.
Okay, like a true false or a score.
Yeah, or a score.
Okay.
That's a good one.
Got it.
Or counts. How many accounts do they have open anywhere? How many dollars do they have?
Okay.
And so if you put all this stuff together, you can get a good profile. Mm-hmm. Or at least even groups of profiles of who tends to apply.
Right.
So what you can then start doing is figuring out who doesn't fit into one of these profiles.
Okay.
And it sounds a lot more complicated than it necessarily has to be, because a lot of us went through math in high school where you had to do the rise over run. You guys remember that?
Right.
You plot a line and you have a rise and you have a run. So you're doing the y-axis change, the x-axis, and you're getting that line.
Yep.
And that tells you how distant the two dots are.
Right.
So if you only had two dimensions, that's all you ever had to do. You could do age and FICO score, although we don't ever use age because we're not allowed to. And we wouldn't risk it. But just for this example, you could do age and FICO score. And just with those two alone, you could probably come up with nice distance measurements where you could say how different people are from each other. So we do that. We just do it with a lot more dimensions.
So as in if someone is – like essentially it identifies outliers because people should be clustering in some sort of pattern.
Yeah.
Okay, got
that's it. That's right. And so that's a simple way to do anomaly detection is the way that I just said it, with some sort of distance measurements for all the features.
Okay.
There are other more sophisticated ways where you start clustering people, like with k-means clustering. You tell it how many groups you think there are, which you can sort of figure out with other statistical work.
Right.
And then it'll do exactly that. Like this person is kind of close to group A, but not in group A, and they sort of feel alone. And it doesn't mean
that nearest neighbor, or is that something else?
Yeah, that's a nearest neighbor method.
Got it.
So that's one route to do it. There's no shortage of them, and every single one of them, there's no such thing as a free lunch in data science. It's a very popular phrase. Mm-hmm. So the work in anomaly detection can kind of be reduced to a few different things. Number one is which features matter. It's going to think all features matter equally if you put them in there. Number two is which algorithms are best in my space, because there is no shortage of them. Like I can use different versions of so one of the cool ones that I've always wanted to play with even more is called Isolation Forest. And so this one is pretty innovative because let's go back to that example I used about age versus FICO, which again we can't use in decision making, at least not the age component. What you do is you just sort of have this algorithm drop thousands of lines or as many lines as you tell it to, either straight vertical or straight horizontal. And the idea is that the more unique something is, the fewer of those lines I'll have to drop to separate it from everybody else.
Okay.
So if you think of it as this big cloud, and I happen to drop a vertical line on one side of the cloud, like that was a really easy way to pull off the people that are on the edge.
Right.
But to get the people in the very middle of the cloud, I'm going to have to drop a ton of lines to get them separate.
Okay, yeah.
And so that's one neat way to detect anomalies as well. So there's no shortage of approaches that we can try, but you have to figure out which ones are going to work best in your space.
Mm.
It's going to be different in every space. What my closest friends out in Houston do for predicting anomalies with wind turbines to go figure out which ones need to get repaired is very different from what I found was useful here.
Right.
And so that's the unsupervised approach. We actually found that neural networks were really powerful for us in this space.
Okay.
And so we have one of those out in production now. But then that's one way to define an anomaly, is the straightforward statistical data science anomaly detection that I just laid out.
Right.
Another way, and this goes back to business use and first principles, is you can track something over time and spot an anomaly because of a sudden shift. And so one of the other things that we've spent a lot of time doing is being able to forecast the profitability of every dealer in every store, or in every dealer that we partner with, and every customer at any point we want. And so if you apply, you'll have a risk score assigned to you, and we know what people with that risk score and your characteristics have historically paid.
Okay.
Then you start paying, and we can tell very quickly whether you're on track for that. And as we get more information, we make new predictions. Where will you be at the end? And if we spot a sudden shift from, say, applications to 2 months in, that's an anomaly too. And if all of a sudden the profitability of the people a store is sending us have tanked, it's not random. Something happened.
Right, right.
And that triggers us to go investigate, figure it out. And so we were really kind of try to be comprehensive. And that's usually the style that we follow at West Creek, is how can we really reduce the problem down to its constituent parts and make sure that whatever solutions we come up with cover the gamut, that truly cover the pipeline from end to end.
Right. So you guys settled on – you started with the supervised model, had a hard time predicting the future.
Yeah.
So
at least unique ones. It actually predicts the exact same kind of frauds pretty well.
Right. Exactly. So new scenarios were hard to identify. And so as a result, you guys started using an unsupervised model and even a neural network.
That's right.
To break things into categories.
Mm-hmm. You got it. And then we also had the final supervised model, but now using the prediction itself from the profitability targets as a way to detect anomalies as well. So that's actually a cool one that we sort of borrowed. Well, a lot of people can come up with it, but it kind of reminded me of a method that NASA uses. So if you can imagine, they don't want to send astronauts out on spacewalks without it being pretty certain that they needed to, because it's kind of dangerous.
Yeah.
And so what they do is they have all these sensors on everything that's on their spacecraft. And they predict the values on each of those sensors as a function of the remainder. So if I've got 10 sensors, they have a lot more than this. But if I've got 10 sensors and I want to predict the first one, I'll use the other 9 to build a model to predict the first one. And if the actual measurement is too different from the predicted measurement, then that's an anomaly. Huh. And that's an anomaly probably worth flagging for review. And you just do that for all of your sensors across the board. So there's a lot of ways to do these really cool dynamic systems.
Yeah.
And a lot of approaches to take. And that's one of the things I love about this work, is that there isn't just one way to solve something.
Are these new methods coming out of the research field, or are these like – have these been long-established sort of statistics strategies that are now being implemented in, you know, the cloud environment, or thanks to all this compute and memory and processing speed?
You nailed it with the second part. So generally speaking, so there are some new methods. So that one about dropping lines that I mentioned, that's a pretty new one that only came out a few years ago, called isolation forest. But almost always, these methods are decades old. And it was just the lack of computing power that prevented us from using it. Wow. So neural networks, I think, are from the 70s.
Yeah.
Random forest was published in a paper in the early 90s. And so those two are pretty famous ones that even people who don't do this work for a living have usually heard about. But if you've noticed, did anybody notice how their speech detection on their phones got a lot better about 5 years ago?
Yeah.
And that's because they started deploying neural networks, because the compute worked for it. So now Google Translate, they did a massive update and added a lot of neural network predictions to it. But Google Translate was measured to be better than human translators now.
That's hilarious. you mentioned AWS and Python and R. What are some of the other components of West Creek's tech stack that are worth mentioning?
Sure.
Like, do you guys use SageMaker? Do you use like EMR? Like, would you use?
Historically, I've hired very programming-oriented data scientists, which is not the same thing that everybody hires for data science. So a lot of the tools like SageMaker are intended to make life easier for people that aren't that comfortable with a command line.
Mm-hmm.
My guys, however, are. So we just deploy ourselves and work real closely with a phenomenal tech team led by Jim Kresge, who came over from Capital One. And we have a lot of phenomenal senior software engineers. And what we've built is this fantastic AWS system that has a conductor that calls through different Lambda functions that have their own containers and all sorts of different rules in it. It's very carefully designed too, so somebody can run through the process. But at the end of the day, the data science side is very Python-centric in terms of deployment.
Mm.
Our research is a lot of Python, a lot of R, a lot of Databricks or Spark, mm-hmm. for if it's particularly big. Like, some of those files that we'll work with will be more than 60 gigabytes of data. And so we can't do that locally. So we leverage big data tools like Spark. But generally speaking, deployment is in Python. That's the data science side of the stack. The software engineering stack has actually changed. So West Creek grew rapidly. And I actually really like the way that they intelligently chose to grow. So the first year or two, they used off-the-shelf software to handle their loans. And I believe they used a Salesforce product for a lot of it.
Okay.
Then they hired an outside group to build the custom software for them. So you can imagine they weren't that big yet in terms of people. Yeah. And then about, let's say, a year, year and a half ago, we got to the spot where we're nice and profitable. We have enormous volumes now. We wanted to bring all this in-house. And Jim Kresge, Jeff Samet, Eric Miles, these phenomenal software engineers over there have led this fantastic effort to move from this big monolith that was written in C# to a much more, modern and open source vision of where we can be. So yeah. Everything's been turned into microservices, a lot of API calls. Golang is really really heavily used. A lot of AWS resources instead of the Azure resources we were using before.
Okay.
And so it probably feels even more comfortable to the people that are looking for really neat work to do in the open source space than it used to when we were more of a C# and .NET shop.
Interesting. One last question about West Creek.
Yeah.
What is one thing that you guys are still having a hard time doing? Like, what's one sort of nut that is still super hard to crack, specifically from like a business standpoint? I'm not as interested, but like I'm definitely interested in from like a technology transformation aspect. Like, what's something that, like, I mean, and the answer could be we're just not there yet, but it's we're just because of the age of the company. But what's something that you guys have still been unable to or had a hard time dealing with?
That is a really good question. So part of what attracted me to West Creek is the fact that it's a startup and it moves fast. And I think this is going to be a common complaint that everybody has, but we feel it even more because of how fast we like to move. There just aren't enough technologists to go around. So the number of projects and ideas that we all would like to do is dwarfed by – or is way too much compared to the pipeline of actual hands that we have to build it.
Mm-hmm.
And so this loan effort that we're launching that is meant to handle people that are lower risk has actually been a wonderful opportunity for our tech team and my data science team to work together to build what the application experience and the back end and the entirety of the process should be using modern principles with all those microservices and Lambda functions calls and everything that I talked about a second ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to find the time to give the same treatment to the older technology that we have, that we need to move over.
Right.
Because we have all these new ideas that we want to do. We've been working heavily on e-commerce integrations with major partners, for instance. It's hard to do all of those things and also make sure that you're switching over your existing legacy software at the same pace. And yeah. So I would say that what we are doing the slowest, and it's by necessity, is not converting our older legacy software as fast as we probably wish we could, although we have hired new people for that, and I'm sure that pace is about to pick up.
Right.
But I think Capital One had a multi-year experience of transitioning away from monolithic stuff and
ongoing, yeah.
Legacy computers and SaaS.
Yeah.
And so we're much farther along than you were years ago, but yeah. it's I don't know that process actually ever stops, right?
Right.
I bet 5 years from now we're going to want to start converting some of the stuff that we converted to.
Exactly. that's a hard thing, because in some workloads you never really want to take off of the legacy hardware or the legacy application because it's doing its job and the ROI is questionable.
Mm-hmm.
So there's so much nuance, and then again, like you said, you'll migrate something to the new hotness, and then, you know, it's only a matter of time until, like, the new hotness is relative.
Yes.
What year it is, because, you know, Lambda functions written in Node might have been the new hotness, but now everyone's like, well, are they written in Python? Because, you know, it's like there's always something else you can do to make stuff better.
Yes. And so for data science, Julia is one of those because it has built-in parallelization and all these kind of cool tools. MIT just released the 1.0 version of it.
Oh, cool.
And so a lot of people that I know that are always interested in the new have been starting to play around more and more with that space because it fixes some of the stuff that these single-thread languages at their heart weren't designed for. But I have another more human challenge that we also struggle with, and I think this is normal for all of the top flight companies around here. There's just not enough talent. And so we personally have chosen to not lower our standards to hire someone, which makes it harder for the people that are there because there's more to be – the same work needs to be done.
Right.
But we are always – I think everyone here in this area is actively hiring and looking for people, trying to find the right people to join.
Right. And if someone heard this and was like, man, I want to be a part of the West Creek team, just go to westcreekfinancial.com.
Westcreekfin.com.
Westcreekfin.com.
Or find me via LinkedIn. We actually do hire straight from college. It's one of the reasons that I love this work is I love teaching this work. So I still volunteer at Texas A&M University and helping master's students. And so I'm actually very open to hiring straight from master's programs and the like because we like to train people up.
Yeah, cool.
And we'll also take people with lots of experience. But the people that we can train up, we can make sure do everything exactly the right way.
That's awesome. All right. So let me pivot and talk about you really quick one more time. So you've given kind of this big high level sort of summary of who is Pablo. I feel like I've kind of got the gist of it. But what is your secret sauce? What is the thing that you do sort of that you're especially good at or that you're when you typically sit in a room, you look around and I'm like, yeah, and you think, yeah, I'm the best person at this certain thing. You know, like everyone's got something where at least they think they have this idea of themselves that they're proud about it. They're really good at it. What's the thing that you kind of hang your hat on or that you sort of consider your secret sauce? And this could be what people have told you, whether or not it's true. Don't take it too seriously.
That's a tough question to answer without sounding like the most arrogant person in the world.
No, I mean, no. I think there's things people are good at and things people aren't good at. You
know? I guess I'll tell you what a really good friend of mine from Houston, who's a phenomenal data scientist and probably the person that I most respect for neural networks in the world, ever said about me when somebody was calling for references, and I'm still touched by it to this day. She described me as Pablo will walk into a room, quickly figure out what the problem is, and then develop the plan and the people to solve it.
Yeah, that's a special skill. A lot of people do either one or the other really well.
No, I really like
I'm really good at walking into the room. The rest of it, I'm not.
What I really like, so to give a different version of that answer, is I think what I really specialize in is figuring out how to solve problems, but then also selecting and building up the right people to help me solve those problems. And I specialize in doing it in a way that really it's the person I'm working with that is solving the problem, and I'm like the bumper rails on the bowling lane that just helps keep them on track. I see a lot of I'm very open about this with my team. I see a lot of my duties and responsibilities as clearing the way for them and helping them prioritize and helping them make intelligent decisions along the way.
Right.
But it's a lot like a doctor to me in that if I trust the doctor, then I'm generally going to do what the doctor recommends because that's the right person for the job.
Right.
And if I'm at the point where I'm arguing with a doctor over and over again about what to be done, then I need to go find a new doctor. And so I'd strive to empower all of my people so that they're like the doctor, where they know the best because they're the closest to the problem and they're making intelligent recommendations. And for them to make intelligent recommendations, my job is to give them context. I don't just tell them to go build this and just leave it at that. You have to tell them to build this and why.
Right.
So that decisions along the way can be made intelligently. Without having to check with you for every single thing. And so I'll switch to one interesting story from history, and it's going to sound weird because I'm going to talk about the Nazis and the Soviets.
That's okay. Yeah.
And the tanks, and the Nazis are the guys that you actually want to be like in this scenario, which is never the case when the story involves the Nazis.
Just so everyone's clear.
Yeah. But one of the I love military history in particular.
Yeah.
And so one of the favorite truisms that people like to say about World War II was that this was a war about tanks, right? It was tanks and Air Force. But tanks were the first time that were ever really heavily used. And one of the ways that Germany could pull off their blitzkriegs, their lightning-fast attacks, was that they leveraged tanks like cavalry, that they would charge forward. Very different from World War I, where they would move really, really slowly through the trench and usually get stuck. But in World War II, they would move in convoys and be rapid, and they'd react. And the Nazis would empower all of their people all of their officers to make intelligent decisions on their own using discretion. And so they were amazing at the beginning. I mean, they stretched they essentially conquered all of Europe, man.
Right.
And that had never been done. Rome couldn't even pull it off. And right. So then you have the Russians, the Soviets. And just before World War II, Stalin had had fears that his generals were going to overthrow him. And so he'd purged, I want to say 1 in 3, but my memory is really hazy now,
right,
of the senior officers. And he'd created this culture of fear where nobody wanted to make their own decisions. So when the Nazis broke the Nazi-Soviet aggression pact or non-aggression pact and invaded the Soviet Union, it is said, I don't know if this is true, but it is said that one of the reasons the Soviets didn't respond very quickly was because Stalin went into catatonic shock about his buddy having betrayed him and hid in his room for a week or two, and nobody had the courage to make a decision without him having signed off on it.
Wow.
And even when they did make the decision, they fought so poorly, partly because they were under-resourced, but also because they couldn't react. So if they were told, hey, the plan is to go over this hill and take that spot, they right. could never change it. And they would have to throw themselves at
right.
it. Whereas the Nazis would have understood why that spot was important because right. they were told. And they'd do something intelligent to accomplish the true objective as opposed to trying to accomplish the stated proxy objective. And
yeah.
that's important in data science
wow.
because a lot of what we do is proxies for what we're looking for. It's not the truth. So when I'm predicting who is committing – like who's the most likely to pay me back, I can't use data from them having completed the full cycle. Because my data set's going to be a lot smaller if I'm waiting for people that have gone all the way through, mm-hmm. at least with the company with my growth. So I have to use proxies. But I got to remember that the proxy is not the end in and of itself.
Right. So when you apply that lesson to management style, you're essentially saying
– you give context to your people. Make
okay.
sure that they understand what they're doing and why, and then empower them. People want to be good at what they do. People
right.
want to have agency and control over what they do. And if you can give them those things, they'll work really hard. And they'll
you're
do a
probably
phenomenal work.
More like, – I think about Stalin. It's probably one of the reasons he went into catatonic shock because he was taking ownership over all of it.
Right.
At least in his head.
Yes.
And
I think you're right.
So he's like I can imagine your sanity and mental health has improved if you can sort of empower people.
Yes.
As
and
well.
I think it ends up being a more productive place for everyone. I think everybody's sanity and mental health gets better.
Yeah.
The one risk here is you just have to make sure that you're seeing how the work is going.
Mm.
And also that you're keeping people from burning themselves out, because if somebody gets too into something, it's a good thing for people to spike
yeah.
their work when they need to and flex in response to things that are happening. But on a regular basis, that can kill somebody and bring their productivity down.
Yeah. Yeah. That's I suffer from that problem. What is like as an engineer, what is some of the ways that – how do you encourage – if an engineer is like super excited about a problem, like if my manager said, hey, dial back, buddy, I'd be like, man, I'm really excited about this. You're going to – like if I dial back, I'm not going to like hit that, that peak. So what's – how do you encourage engineers to sort of calm down, take the big picture in mind and go slower for longer sort of in favor of consistency?
It's tough because you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. So usually for somebody that sounds like what you just described,
mm-hmm.
I'll try to actually remove some of the stuff that they find more painful, let them focus on the thing that they're finding fantastic right now so that they can get through it. But when they do get through it, I make them go take a break.
Mm-hmm.
I strongly suggest that, hey, I know you've been running really hot. Can you please take a Friday or a Monday soon so that you can go just recharge and rest? I also tend to run a shop that is able to work from home. A fair amount,
mm-hmm.
Which helps, I think, with the balance as well.
Right. Awesome. Well, Pablo, I really enjoyed this conversation. And
likewise.
If people want to find you, LinkedIn, Pablo.
Yeah, but Ormachea, O-R-M-A-C-H-E-A. It's pronounced like hold my chair, Ormachea.
And are you on like social media or just LinkedIn?
I use Twitter a lot, but I primarily use it to follow people in the R sphere because all of the major people that I know of, major developers, are extraordinarily active. So
yeah.
It's a phenomenal way to stay on top of new packages.
Same with Cloud Native. It's so funny. All the people are just super active on Twitter.
Yeah. So I'd say I'm pretty passive.
Okay.
More than active on Twitter. I'm reading things, but occasionally
yeah.
you'll see some likes. And if you go to me on Twitter, it's not my professional account.
Okay.
So while I'm not blaring about politics, I mean, you might find an errant like or two for a candidate you might not like.
All right. So, and they can find you on Twitter at Pablo.
I think it's P. Ormachea. But it might just be Ormachea. For a while there, my account was hacked, fair warning. So if you scroll really far back in my history, you're going to see these weird paintings with like Arabic written on them. So I'm pretty sure that they used me as a vector for like ISIS recruiting or something. And Twitter at the time didn't have a good way to delete all of them. So I gave up after trying to get rid of some of them.
That's hilarious. awesome. Well, thanks again.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. All right, guys, tune in 2 weeks for the next episode of RVA Tech Talks. And as always, we're tremendously appreciative of this week's sponsor, Summit Human Capital. And please reach out to them at summithumancapital.com. Also, quick shout out to Canvas, where we recorded this episode. And you can find them at meetatcanvas.com. And a shout out to Claire Morgan at Knotterly.com, who edited this episode.